In the summer of 1912, a quiet Iowa town woke to find 8 of its own. 2 parents, 4 children, and 2 overnight guests. Hacked to death with an axe while they slept. No warning, no witnesses, no justice. The killer covered mirrors, locked the doors, and vanished. Forever. Over a century later, no one has answered the question that still grips America. Who slaughtered the Moore family and why? Some say it was a jealous rival. Others, a traveling preacher. And still others believe it was the work of a serial killer who moved through the country like smoke. This is the story of fear, of failure, and of a house that still remembers every scream that was never heard. Welcome to Villisca, where the shadows never left. So, if you think you've heard it all, you haven't. Hit follow on your favorite platform now, because the next story might just change the way you see everything. Don't miss a single twisted turn. Chapter 1, A Town Before Terror. Some towns are known for what they build, others for what they survive. In the summer of 1912, Villisca, Iowa was the kind of place that barely made headlines. Tucked into the gentle heartland of America, it was a quiet farming town with wide dirt roads, white picket fences, and an unwavering rhythm shaped by crop seasons, church bells, and front porch gossip. The kind of town where children walked home from school in clusters, where the general store cashier knew your name and your mother's pie recipe. Its population hovered just over 2,000. Neighbors weren't just familiar. They were extended family. Sunday school, town socials, and church functions knitted the town into something tight, something decent, something unbreakable, or so it seemed. Among the most respected families in town were the Moores. Josiah Joe Moore was a successful businessman who owned the local John Deere franchise. He was proud, punctual, and deeply embedded in Villisca's community life. His wife, Sarah Montgomery Moore, was active in the Presbyterian Church and known for her warmth, discipline, and devotion to their children. Their home at 508 East 2nd Street was modest but cheerful. A 2-story white house with simple furnishings, a coal stove, and a family Bible always within reach. Inside, the Moore children, 11-year-old Herman, 10-year-old Mary Catherine, 7-year-old Boyd, and 5-year-old Paul filled the house with life, laughter, and the kind of innocent noise only children can make. The family was admired. They were involved, well-liked, and most importantly, seemingly untouchable. On weekends, Joe Moore played horseshoes with fellow businessmen. Sarah coordinated Sunday school activities. The children helped with chores and attended school just a few blocks away. There was never a reason to worry, never a reason to look over one shoulder. But like many quiet towns of the era, Villisca had no formal police department. Law enforcement consisted of a local marshal, with backup typically arriving hours or days later from neighboring counties. Crimes, when they occurred, were minor. A stolen chicken, a drunken scuffle, nothing more. So when Sunday, June 9th, rolled around, there was no hint, no warning, that Villisca was about to enter the dark pages of American criminal history. That morning, the Moore family dressed in their finest and headed to the Presbyterian Church for Children's Day. an annual service celebrating the youngest in the congregation. It was a full evening of singing, recitations, and refreshments. The Stillinger sisters, Lena, 12, and Ina May, 8, were invited by Mary Catherine to spend the night afterward. Their parents agreed. It was the kind of invitation you never questioned in a town like Villisca. After the program, the 8 souls, 6 from the Moore family, and the 2 Stillinger girls walked home under a clear Iowa sky. The streets were calm. The night was cool. Lamps flickered in windows as households prepared for bed. No one knew it would be the last time anyone saw them alive. The moon rose over Villisca. The lights dimmed. And somewhere in the shadows, death was already waiting. Chapter 2, The Final Day. Sometimes horror doesn't announce itself. It waits until everything feels just right. Sunday, June 9th, 1912, began like any other summer day in Villisca. The sun rose early, golden light spilling over fields of corn and wheat. Children played in the yards. Church bells chimed, echoing across the small town with familiar comfort. Inside the Moore household, the family stirred with quiet routine. Sarah laid out Sunday bests for the children. Josiah, or Joe as everyone called him, packed his pocket watch and straightened his tie. The children, Herman, Mary Catherine, Boyd, and Paul, laughed as they helped one another prepare. That day, they weren't just going to church. They were performing in it. It was Children's Day at the Presbyterian Church, an annual celebration that brought families together for music, skits, and devotionals presented entirely by the youth. Sarah Moore had coordinated much of the event, organizing songs and rehearsals for weeks in advance. It was a moment of pride, a display of innocence, family, and faith. Mary Catherine had invited 2 friends to join the festivities, Lena Gertrude Stillinger, 12, and her younger sister Ina May, 8. Their parents agreed. The Stillinger girls were daughters of Joseph and Sarah Stillinger, hard-working farmers who lived on the outskirts of town. After the church event, they would sleep over at the Moore house. That night, the Moore family and the Stillinger sisters arrived at the church around 8 p.m. The building was alive with voices, laughter, and song. Pews were filled. The children recited Bible verses, sang hymns, and performed skits that left the congregation smiling. Multiple witnesses recalled seeing Reverend George Kelly, a traveling preacher, seated quietly in a pew. He was known for his erratic behavior, awkward presence, and nervous energy. No one thought much of it. Kelly often passed through towns like Villisca, promoting sermons and publishing his self-written religious tracts. That evening, he observed the children's program without a word. After the final hymn, the Moores and the Stillinger sisters walked home together. It was near 9:30 p.m. The town was quiet. Storefronts were shuttered. Horses stood still beneath gas-lit lamps. Neighbors reported seeing Joe Moore unlocking the front door just before 10 p.m. One neighbor remembered the porch light flickering. Another recalled hearing the clatter of a coal scuttle. Nothing sounded out of place. Inside the home, the Stillinger girls were given a small guest room on the main floor. The Moore children went upstairs to bed. Joe and Sarah retired to their bedroom. Doors were locked, lamps were turned down, curtains were drawn. Outside, Villisca went to sleep, unaware that someone else had not. In the attic of the Moore house, 2 discarded cigarette butts would later be found. Silent testimony that someone had been waiting, watching, listening, breathing in the smoke of calm before unleashing the storm. Whoever it was, they knew the house, knew the layout, knew how long to wait, knew when the town would be asleep, and they knew that axe was waiting in the shed. The house grew quiet, breath by breath, moment by moment. The night thickened, and when the clock passed midnight, Villisca was no longer the town it had been. Chapter 3. The Butcher in the Attic. Evil didn't break into the house. It let itself in, and then it waited. Sometime between 10 p.m. and midnight on June 9, 1912, the house at 508 East 2nd Street grew quiet. The Moore family and their two young guests had all gone to bed. The oil lamps flickered low. The front door was locked. The town of Villisca was sound asleep. But someone else was already inside. In the attic, a cramped, unfinished crawlspace above the second floor, two half-smoked cigarettes were later found. They weren't old. They weren't dusty. They were fresh. The presence of those cigarettes would become one of the only physical traces of what may have happened in the hours that followed. Investigators believe the killer had entered earlier that day, possibly during the church service when the house was empty. They crept in unnoticed, slipped up into the attic, and waited in suffocating silence as the family went about their evening. No one heard footsteps above the ceiling. No one suspected a thing. And then, as midnight passed, the killer descended. The exact timeline of the murders is uncertain, but the brutality was unmistakable. The killer's weapon was the family's own axe, a tool usually kept in the backyard shed. It was heavy, sharp, and merciless. Josiah Moore was likely the first to die. He suffered more than any other. Struck approximately 30 times in the head, his wounds were so severe that the axe gouged the ceiling above the bed from the force. His face was unrecognizable. The killer used the blade's blunt end, not the sharp edge, delivering blow after blow in an act of chilling overkill. Sarah was next. Struck while sleeping beside her husband, she died almost instantly. There was no sign of a struggle. From there, the killer moved silently to the children's room. Herman, the eldest at 11, never stood a chance. Nor did Mary Catherine, Boyd, or little Paul. All were killed in their beds, brutally, efficiently, and without a single scream loud enough to alert a neighbor. Then the killer descended the stairs. Ina May and Lena Stillinger slept in the guest room on the main floor. Ina was murdered in her sleep. Lena, however, appeared to have awakened. Her body was found sideways across the bed, her nightgown pushed up, with defensive wounds on her arm. She had fought back. It's unclear whether there was a sexual assault. Evidence was inconclusive, and much was lost to contamination. But the suggestive staging of Lena's body left a haunting implication. Her murder was not just violent. It may have been personal. Once the killing was done, the scene became even more disturbing. The murderer took the time to cover each victim's face with clothing or bed sheets. Mirrors were draped. The axe was wiped clean and left leaning against the wall in the Stillinger room, next to a slab of raw bacon, taken from the kitchen icebox and wrapped in a towel. Another piece of bacon sat on the dining room floor. The killer stayed long enough to fill a bowl with water, used, it seemed, to wash their hands. Then they locked every door in the house and vanished into the night. In total silence, 8 lives were extinguished, and yet no one heard the screams. No one saw the killer leave, and by the time the town awoke, it was already too late. Chapter 4. Discovery at Dawn. When the sun rose over Villisca on June 10th, it found a town unchanged. But inside one house, the world had already ended. The morning of Monday, June 10th, 1912, began like any other in Villisca. Roosters crowed, farmers prepared for the day's labor. The slow heartbeat of small-town Iowa resumed its rhythm, unaware that something terrible had happened while it slept. At 5 a.m., Mary Peckham, the Moore's next-door neighbor, stepped outside to hang laundry. She found it odd that no one from the Moore household was out yet. The family was known for their punctuality, especially Joe Moore, who always tended to chores before business hours. By 7 a.m., Peckham grew more concerned. The house was quiet. The curtains were still drawn. No movement, no sound. At 8 a.m., she knocked. No response. Alarmed, she called Josiah's brother, Ross Moore, who arrived minutes later with a spare key. Peckham watched nervously from her porch as Ross entered through the front door. He didn't get far. Just inside, in the downstairs guest room, he saw what no brother ever should, the lifeless bodies of Ina and Lena Stillinger. Blood stained the sheets. A dark presence lingered in the air. He stepped back, shaking, speechless. Ross ran from the house and shouted for help. Within minutes, Marshal Hank Horton arrived. He entered slowly, moving room to room. Upstairs, he found the Moore children, and then Joe and Sarah, all murdered in their beds. The house had become a tomb. The horror spread quickly. News traveled faster than protocol. Before law enforcement could secure the scene, townspeople began arriving in waves. Neighbors, friends, curious onlookers. There were no barricades, no police line. People walked through the home, up the stairs, into bedrooms. Some even took souvenirs. According to reports, one man lifted a piece of Josiah's skull from the floor and passed it around like an artifact. Others touched the axe, opened drawers, smudged blood, left footprints. Any chance at a clean investigation was obliterated within hours. No one meant to compromise the scene, but in a town where such violence had never occurred, the idea of criminal procedure was foreign. There was no protocol, no FBI, no forensic team en route. By noon, the house was a carnival of chaos. A sacred scene turned spectacle. The bodies were removed that afternoon. The entire family and the Stillinger girls were transported to a local funeral home where undertakers prepared them for burial. Grief swept over the town like a second death. Church bells rang, schools closed, stores lowered their awnings. 8 people, 4 children, 2 guests, and 2 parents were gone. But the killer had left no note, no fingerprints, no motive, no sign of forced entry, only the axe, the bacon, and the silence. Villisca's innocence was over, not because of what had happened, but because no one could say why. Chapter 5. A Town Turns on Itself. When evil wears no face, even your neighbor starts to look like a killer. In the hours after the murders, grief swept through Villisca, but grief quickly gave way to something darker, fear, deep, infectious fear, and in a town with no answers, fear needed a face. The funeral was held just days later. The 6 members of the Moore family and the Stillinger sisters were laid to rest in identical white coffins lined up in a row. Over 2,000 mourners attended, more than the population of the town itself. Local businesses shut down. The church was silent except for sobs. But even as prayers filled the sanctuary, suspicion crept through the pews. Who could do such a thing? And worse, what if they were still here? Villisca fractured almost overnight. The idea that a stranger had slipped in, murdered 8 people with an axe, and walked away unseen was too much for the town to bear. It felt impossible, unthinkable. Someone, they believed, must have known the victims. Someone inside the town. Rumors swirled like dust in the summer air. Neighbors began watching one another closely. Locks were installed on doors that had never needed them. Fathers stayed up with rifles. Mothers kept children indoors. Friends stopped speaking. Accusations were whispered behind closed doors. Fear turned neighbor against neighbor. The media only fanned the flames. Newspapers from Des Moines to Chicago devoured the story. Mass murder in Iowa. 8 killed in sleep by madmen. Headlines screamed theories, offered suspect sketches, and hinted at cults, madness, and roving killers. The lack of facts didn't stop the appetite for horror. Villisca, once unknown, had become a national obsession and a living crime scene. Local police were overwhelmed. There was no blueprint for an investigation of this scale. Evidence had been compromised, motive was unclear, and the killer had vanished without trace. So authorities turned to instinct, pressure, and politics. Suspects were rounded up, not based on evidence, but on difference. Strangers were detained at train depots. Drifters were interrogated without cause. A man with blood on his shirt was pulled off a rail car only to be released when it turned out to be paint. Then came the first real suspect, Reverend George Kelly. Kelly had left Villisca by train on the morning of June 10th. He had attended the church service the night before the murders and was known for his bizarre behavior, small, nervous, paranoid. He wrote letters to young girls, preached in erratic, frenzied tones. He was a man who didn't fit, and in a town that needed a villain, not fitting was enough. Still, the evidence was flimsy. No one had seen him near the Moore house. He had no criminal history. But Kelly couldn't help himself. He wrote strange letters about the murders. He spoke of visions. He seemed obsessed with the case. And then he confessed. In a letter, he wrote that God had whispered to him, told him to slay utterly. He later retracted it, then confessed again, then changed the story. By the time investigators tried to use the confession in court, it was already unraveling. The trial ended in a hung jury. A second trial found him not guilty. Kelly walked free, and Villisca was no closer to justice. With no killer, no trial, and no peace, Villisca began to rot from the inside. The real murderer had vanished, but their shadow still lingered on every front porch. Chapter 6, Trials and Theories. Sometimes the greatest threat to truth is too many answers. After the acquittal of Reverend George Kelly, the case didn't close. It shattered. Public trust in the justice system eroded. Townspeople who had once stood united in grief were now divided by suspicion, shame, and fear. If not Kelly, then who? And why had the killer escaped not only punishment, but understanding? The answer wasn't just elusive, it was multiplying. Frank F. Jones. The next suspect was someone from the heart of Villisca itself, a wealthy state senator and former employer of Josiah Moore. Jones owned a competing hardware business. Years earlier, Josiah had worked for him selling John Deere equipment until he broke away and opened his own dealership. Some said there was bad blood, business resentment, even rumors that Josiah had an inappropriate relationship with Jones's daughter-in-law. But most damning was the theory that Jones hadn't killed the Moores himself. He had hired someone. That someone, according to whispers, was William Blackie Mansfield, a known criminal with a violent record. Mansfield had allegedly murdered his own wife, child, and parents-in-law in Blue Island, Illinois. The method? An axe. He was arrested. Investigators tied him to other similar axe murders across Kansas and Illinois. But his alibi for the Villisca killings, confirmed payroll records from Illinois, held up. Mansfield was released. Once again, the case returned to square one. Then came the most terrifying theory of all. A serial killer. Not one from Villisca. Not a drifter. Not even someone known to the victims. But a phantom who moved silently from town to town, killing entire families in the dead of night. In 2017, author Bill James published The Man from the Train, suggesting that Villisca was part of a larger pattern, a string of axe murders from the late 1800s through the early 1910s. Families killed in their beds, lights extinguished, curtains drawn, mirrors covered. The killer often used the blunt end of the axe and always left the murder weapon at the scene. The theorized suspect was Paul Müller, a German immigrant and fugitive wanted for a family murder in Massachusetts. James and his daughter found over 30 killings across the United States and Canada, matching his supposed modus operandi. Villisca fit almost perfectly, but Müller was never caught, never named by authorities, never stood trial. His face, if it ever was known, vanished with time. More than a century later, the list of suspects still reads like a nightmare. A reverend, a senator, a drifter, a foreign ghost. And no one, not one, was ever convicted. Theories became folklore. Folklore became legend. And somewhere beneath it all, the truth was buried. The Moore family and the Stillinger girls were gone. Their murderer, just a shadow, moving farther away with each passing year. The horror of Villisca wasn't just what happened. It was what never did. The sound of a gavel falling, the truth told aloud, the justice denied forever. Chapter 7, The House That Remembers. Some places don't forget. They breathe, they whisper, they watch. By the late 20th century, the murders of the Moore family and the Stillinger girls had long passed into legend. No one living could recall the faces of the victims. No new evidence had surfaced. The case remained frozen. 8 lives extinguished, no justice served. But one thing endured. The house, 508 East 2nd Street, remained in Villisca. It had changed hands over the years, falling into disrepair, its paint peeling, floorboards sagging under time's weight. Many who lived there claimed unease, strange sounds, chills, a heaviness that seemed to settle into the walls. In 1994, the house was purchased by Darwin and Martha Lynn. They saw not just a crumbling property, but a historic opportunity. The Lynns restored the home to its 1912 condition, down to the oil lamps, the furniture, and the wood stove. Their goal was clear: to honor the victims, preserve the site, and offer the public a direct connection to America's most chilling, unsolved murder. But they also opened the door to something darker. The house became the Villisca Axe Murder House, a museum by day, a ghost story by night. visitors walked the same hallways the killer once crept through. They stood at the foot of the Stillinger bed, stared at the attic door, and whispered to shadows. Soon, stories emerged. Tour guides reported cold spots, sudden temperature drops that moved through the room like breath. Guests claimed to hear footsteps upstairs when no one was there. Doors slammed without warning, lamps flickered, then went dark. The most famous reports came from paranormal investigators, teams equipped with infrared cameras, audio recorders, and electromagnetic sensors. They claimed to capture whispered voices, childlike laughter, and groans echoing through the walls. One group, dubbed the Ghost Moms, recorded an incident where the hair was tugged in the attic. Others reported scratches, possession-like trances, or being overcome with nausea while standing in the children's room. Skeptics scoffed, but believers flocked. The Villisca Axe Murder House became a sensation, featured on ghost hunting shows, true crime podcasts, and social media. It offered overnight stays for those brave enough. Many lasted only a few hours before leaving, shaken, disturbed, and changed. But beneath the ghost stories lies something harder to face. That house isn't haunted because of the supernatural. It's haunted because of what was allowed to happen. Because no one stopped it. Because no one paid for it. For the Moore and Stillinger descendants, the transformation of their loved one's home into a tourist destination is bittersweet. Some see it as remembrance, others as exploitation. But no one denies its power. 508 East 2nd Street is more than a house. It is a wound in the shape of a home, and wounds that deep don't heal. They echo. In Villisca, history doesn't gather dust. It creaks. It whispers. It waits. Chapter 8. Shadows without end. Time passed. But the blood never dried. It only faded and spread. More than a century has passed since the night of June 9, 1912. The town of Villisca has moved on, but not really. It exists in two timelines. The present, where tourists stop for ghost tours and antiques, and the past, where the shadow of 8 unsolved murders still stretches down East 2nd Street. The Villisca Axe murders remain one of the oldest and most chilling cold cases in American history. It's not just because of the brutality or the mystery or the eerie details. It's because it should have been solved. And it wasn't. There were suspects, there were trials, there were fingerprints, witnesses, a community that wanted answers. But somehow, none of it led to justice. And that may be the real horror. In the years since, dozens of theories have surfaced. Newspapers, books, podcasts, documentaries, all promising to reveal the truth behind Villisca, each one offering a different suspect, a different motive, a different story. But no theory has brought closure. Because how do you bring closure to a case where children were butchered in their sleep and no one heard a sound? How do you explain a killer so methodical, so precise, that they wiped down the murder weapon, covered the mirrors, locked the doors, and vanished forever? How do you honor victims whose final moments were spent in terror, while the world outside slept peacefully? The Moore family lies buried in Villisca Cemetery, beneath identical tombstones marked only by names and dates. The Stillinger sisters were buried in their family plot, a short ride away, but forever linked in tragedy. They are gone, but the killer is not. Whether buried, renamed, or lost in the folds of history, the person who committed these crimes evaded justice, not by brilliance, but by timing, by silence, by a system that didn't yet know how to solve a mass murder. And that failure continues to echo. The Villisca Axe Murder House still stands. Some go there to feel fear. Others go to feel connection. But most go because they're haunted, not by ghosts, but by the truth that still hides inside the walls. And in that way, the story never ends. It waits in silence, just like it began. There are crimes so deep. They stain more than the floorboards. They stain belief itself, in safety, in neighbors, in justice. Villisca was one of them, and it always will be.